Okay, we'll get started. So today we're going to, this week we're going to be looking at memory, human memory. And particularly today we're going to look at some examples of where it goes wrong in order to better understand how it works. And then tomorrow we'll look a bit more at memory models, and then on Friday at the sort of effects you might have from memory or where memory fails, in particular in relation to a couple of applications such as eyewitness identification. Okay, so when you look at human memory, there are different types, different functions, different locations in the brain. It's not just one simple system. It's more complex than that. So there are different types of human memory, and they may act in different ways. They may be located in different parts of the brain, and we'll talk a bit more about those today and tomorrow. But all types of memory, generally, what they're involved in is storing and retrieving information. So basically, any information you take in from the outside world that you want to retain in some way obviously has to be stored in some form of memory. You also want to be able to retain it over time, and that could be for a very short time period, it could be for a very long period. I mean, you might think, well, okay, what's the earliest thing you remember? Or it might be, you know, what I said 2 seconds ago. And the different functions, the different memory functions that exist, there's interaction between them as well. That is, there are interaction between the different processes to move from one to the other. So we're not talking about a single task, we're talking about a number of components and various different types of processing. And in particular, as I said, tomorrow we'll talk a bit more about the sorts of models of memory that exist. Okay, now sometimes memory fails. It could be that parts of the memory get damaged. So it may be part that records general facts, for example, semantic memory, and we'll say a bit more about the different types of memory a bit later. Or it could be about what happens in your life. So if you're recalling events in relation to your own life, that's episodic memory. If you can't, you sometimes get people with brain damage where they can remember everything up to a certain point, but nothing beyond that. Or that they can't create any new consciously accessible memories after that point. And that's just some of the examples we'll talk about today. And that's referred to as anti-retrograde amnesia. We all experience forgetting. I mean, you'll know yourselves from sitting in any exam, you know, or being asked questions when you're not expecting, or when you believe you, sometimes you know the answer to something, but you just can't retrieve it. It's in there, but you haven't actually lost it. Or it may simply be sometimes that you forgot it. Maybe it's no longer accessible. So what we're going to look at is some things, obviously they're things we experience all the time, just fairly simple forgetting. But what we're going to look at today is much more severe versions of that and see what that tells us about how human memory works. In the process, there are various things that you may or may not know about memory. So in the process of recalling items from memory, the process of retrieving them, you may actually change them. And one of the things we'll talk about on Friday when we talk about things like eyewitness misidentification is how, depending on the context or the questions you may be asked or the situation in which you experience them in, actual process of retrieval itself may change a memory. So the way you're asked, the language, they can actually distort the contents. Also, you'll be familiar yourselves with a number of times, you know, you're confident that you know something, or you're confident that your memory is correct of an event. And you may be arguing with someone who has experienced exactly the same event, and their memory will be different, and they will be equally confident that they are correct. Now, clearly, one of you's remembered it wrong, or what's going on there? But it is the case that it's not as straightforward. You know, memory isn't just simply like computer storage, where if you store something, then you know that what you retrieve, what you get back, will be what you put in. Human memory is much more complex than that. It's also the case that actually forgetting is quite important, that you actually do want to not always keep remembering everything. There may be cases where forgetting is a good thing, but I won't go into detail on that just now. Okay, but overall, when we look at human memory, it is extremely robust. Its main purpose is information processing. And remember, we talked about the general approach we take, the general model of human so we have is a cognitive model, and it's an information processing model. Generally, memory works pretty well, and it's pretty robust. One way that we study memory and that we study deficits in memory is by doing the sorts of studies we've talked about when we were looking at other parts of the course. When we looked at attention, we looked at vision. We talked about the sorts of traditional studies where you have a hypothesis, you have a theory, you have a theory that leads you to a hypothesis, you then come up with a question you want to test, you design a study to do it, you may do it on a number of participants, and your goal overall is to generalize to the wider population. That is, you want to learn something about attention in general or vision in general, or it might be you run studies for memory in general. So for example, in the lab last week, you looked at the memory, the forgetting curve, and you looked at things like primacy and recency effects. That if you give people a whole list of words, they tend to remember best the first ones and the last ones. Now, if you remember, you have the curve, I think it's the Ebbinghaus curve, that shows you on the recall. Now, studies have been done, large-scale studies. Those things have been shown to be generally true, and that's a finding. But that comes about through doing studies on a lot of people, looking at generalization, fairly traditional sort of experimental studies. Now, there is another way to do studies, and I'll say that in a minute, is case studies. So if we look at things like memory studies, if you look at the textbook that you recommended, or if you look anywhere about memory studies, you'll find that typically they're done on large bunches of students, actually quite often on university students, often university psychology students, partly because they happen to be the people that may be accessible. Whether or not you think they're totally representative is another factor. But broadly, you're looking at large-scale study, generalization. But how do you find out about instances where memory is not functioning? So one question would be, if you have damage to your memory, what does it affect? Now, you remember we talked about manipulation and observation experiments the other day. And I said, okay, there are some ethical considerations here. There may be things you want to manipulate, but ethically it's not appropriate to do so. So in order to explore memory, it is not ethically correct to go around and hit people on the head and look and see what the impact would be on their memory, clearly. So we cannot do a manipulation experiment of that type. Some people might think there would be people they would feel that experiment would be appropriate for. But what instead we do is we actually, rather than create a group to study that have had some sort of damage and look at the impact, there are cases that occur where this has happened for other reasons, and it might be due to injury, it might be due to disease or illness, or it might be due to intentional surgical procedures that are designed to fix some other problem, but to have the side effect of affecting memory. Okay, so we can look at these sorts of cases in order to better understand memory. So if you look generally at the medical domain, if you look at, for example, any medical journal, you'll find a lot of the time there's a mixture. You'll find a mixture of things that are a big, large-scale studies. So for example, drug treatment studies. The way they work is huge, large-scale, large numbers, very tightly controlled methodology, experimental manipulations. Then there are a whole bunch of other research literature out there, particularly in, for example, medicine or in, you know, neuropsychology or these areas, that focus on individual cases that say, okay, here we've got a situation where this person has had some damage, and the consequence is, by looking at what they can and can't do, it tells us something about how this process works in what we might refer to as a neurotypical person. So in general, to a large extent, you're all neurotypical. That is, you know, you have, I hope, mostly, you know, fully functioning cognitive processes. There are cases, clearly, where there might be small, even amongst, you know, the student population, there are people that may have particular difficulties. We talked about things like autism previously. You might have, for example, dyslexia. These would be things where you would say, okay, that's not neurotypical, but we can look and see what sort of differences there are between individuals and the general population to better understand what's actually going on and how things work. Now, we're going to be looking here at more extreme examples in relation to memory. So where, for some reason, people have experienced damage through either illness or injury, and this has affected their cognitive processing. And one way you might think of this is almost like a natural experiment. That is, it has happened, and now we can look at the consequences. The same way as I was saying earlier, people in the past were interested, well, they're still interested in, but the cases where, for example, you're looking at nature-nurture and you look and see where siblings have grown up together or apart, clearly you can't separate them just to test that, but there are cases where that's happened, particularly in the past, that you can use to explore it. So the thing about a case study here is the value is it's not representative. That is, you're not arguing that it's representative of some population you can generalize, which you are doing typically with the sorts of experimental studies that you run elsewhere. What you're saying is, because of the particular case, because of its intrinsic interest, it may tell you something about a general phenomena that is more broadly applicable, but because it's been damaged. So there have been a number of unusual cases that have made significant contributions to our understanding, to understanding in neuroscience, in cognitive processing, and in particular in relation to memory and other brain functions. You know, it may surprise you to know now, but, you know, researchers previously didn't realize certain functions are localized in particular areas of the brain. Or that certain functions may be part of the same systems, you know, that interact and relate and may be dependent on each other. However, some of these examples that we're going to look at, and some of the examples, other examples people have found, they're exactly what changed people's minds on this, that made them realize, you know, there was some localization of function. There is interaction between different components, between different processes in the brain. So the example we're going to look at is the case of, well, we'll look briefly at this example of HM later, but there's another case we want to look at in more detail first. So just a quick ahead. So HM was a patient who had severe epileptic seizures. And this was at a time when there weren't so many drugs around to control this. And it may be that when he was a child, he had an accident, he was hit, he banged his head. And it may be that that was actually the initial cause of the epilepsy. But one of the readings for that, which I'll point you to, and is actually will be on the readings page and is also in these slides, is actually the guy's obituary. And his obituary talks about him as a case, how he actually had, you know, this accident, how he then had seizures. And what happened at that time, I think this was in the 50s, the only way they could find to help him was actually to remove his hippocampal lobes. Okay, so brain surgery was intentionally carried out on this patient in order to improve his general state of being. Unfortunately, at that time, they didn't realize that this also would do severe damage to his memory. Okay, now we know that. We don't do this. We certainly don't do it lightly. And they didn't do it lightly then, but they also didn't know then enough about how the brain worked to realize, yes, this might stop his seizures, but also it might have other effects on him that actually might be quite severe. So the area where they did the surgery also was responsible for long-term memory. So we'll come back to him a bit later in the lecture. But before that, I want to talk about another case. Now, this is the case of Clive Waring, referred to as the man with a 30-second memory. Okay, so sometimes you can have a memory deficit, but you can still carry on. You know, the same with many other disabilities. You can carry on largely, you know, in life, you know, maybe further support, maybe various coping mechanisms. In this case, the deficit may be sufficiently severe that you might not be able to function independently. So this guy is a case of that, where the deficit was so extreme that he couldn't actually just live anything like a normal life even. Well, he actually did manage to live a life, but with help. So he was a professional musician, and he's an example of an extreme deficit, and it's probably the most severe case ever recorded of anti-retrograde and retrograde amnesia. And I'll explain more what that means in his case as we go along. What actually happened is he had a near-fatal brain infection, encephalitis, and it damaged parts of his brain primarily responsible for memory. That's the main things, the main area it damaged. And it meant he couldn't store information for more than a few seconds, and it also deleted a lot of his previous memories. Okay, so pretty severe. So he can't create new memories. He can't remember anything from his previous life, except he remembers his wife. She's the only person he recognizes. No one else. You could meet him every day. You could spend every day with him, and he would, a few seconds later, forget he'd met you. Okay, but he always remembers his wife. And in one of the videos I'll show you, you'll see how it's almost like every time he sees her, it's like he's seen her for the first time, but he knows who she is. So he also remembers that he loves music and he can play. So those things he's kept, and pretty much the rest he's lost, although maybe other things prior to a certain date that he may remember. So for more than 20 years, he's felt like he's just recovered consciousness for the first time. So imagine the point when you wake up or you've been unconscious and you come round. That's what his life is like all the time. Okay? He makes notes in his diary, and the clip I'm going to show you is in relation to this. So he makes notes in his diary as a strategy to try and help him, but then he crosses them out because he doesn't remember having made them or what they refer to. Okay, so even the strategy he has makes this difficult. And as I said, every time he sees his wife, even if she's only left him for a few seconds, he actually greets her, I mean, with, as you say, joy and relief. He's really pleased to see her because he thinks he's been alone among strangers until he sees her every time. Okay, and let's see if we can get this to work, if it hasn't dropped out. Okay, this is just taking, it's just taking time. And if it doesn't work, I may have to switch to using the PC for it. Okay, just give it a minute. Hang on. Meanwhile, while I wait for it to come up, I'm just going to log into the PC just in case. Okay, right. Okay, let's just see if I can get up on here instead. Sorry. Sorry, I'm just going to pull up on this. Okay. Okay, I should be able to play it now.
No dreams, no Timothy, day and night, no sight, no sound, no taste, no...
Okay.
I've nothing to say about it.
Okay, so this is his wife talking about him.
Been able to do a formal evaluation of his music. Some people interested in the neuropsychology of music have heard his tapes or videotapes of him playing. And it certainly seems that his skills, his musical skills have not been affected by the illness. He may now be a little rusty and a bit slower because he's not practiced so much. So I think what that tells us about the functioning of the brain is that what's been damaged in Clive are not the areas concerned with music. Another interesting aspect about his deficits now are that he has quite significant semantic memory impairments as well as episodic memory impairments. So not only does he forget things that have just happened or that he's just seen, but he has, to some extent, lost his general knowledge about things. He doesn't know, for example, if he sees a photograph of the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, he thinks they might have been in his choir. And it's very hard for him to tell you in any detail much information, even things he knew prior to the illness. He's been virtually unable to learn anything since the onset of the illness. And again, that's different from some amnesic people. There have been reports of a few who, despite a very severe episodic memory, have managed to learn new vocabulary, learn new acronyms like AIDS or whatever. And Clive, by and large, hasn't learned anything. We were talking earlier today about the new information that he has acquired since the onset of his illness. And we think there might be four or five things. He will, if questioned appropriately, tell you about the reunification of Germany, about Hong Kong going back to China, about the breakup of the Soviet Union. Although if you ask him directly whether these things have happened, he'll say, I don't know. But the way we can find out that he does have some knowledge of that is because he says things like, has Hong Kong gone back to China yet, if you start talking about Hong Kong?
So he knows,
but
it's he can't
very,
say
very
it,
tiny
but he knows he's aware
of information, it. You know, given the extent that he watches television and he does get a daily newspaper.
Magnetic resonance imaging scans of Clive's brain were done in England in 1991. Dr. Aaron Bigler of Brigham Young University recently examined and interpreted these scans to correlate them with Clive's cognitive abilities and deficits.
In this three-dimensional reconstruction of the brain from an MRI in this subject, what we've done is we've colorized the surface of the brain here in this flesh tone, and you can see the Sylvian fissure here very clearly. That divides the frontal lobe from the temporal lobe. And then we make this cut across at about this level here, and that allows us to look face on to the subject in this view right here. This is the coronal view. And so there's the Sylvian fissure, there is
okay,
a healthy temporal lobe. Down in this region right here, this is where the hippocampus and the amygdala reside. If we now look at...
Okay, so the other bit of a clip to show you that is... Okay, so this is his wife
Clive's
talking
day
about his diaries.
That he continually makes entries in his diary. Now, I say makes entries in his diary rather than keeps a diary, because in fact he's not keeping the diary.
It is an inner compulsion to record the momentous event of waking up, because Clive's perception of his own condition is that because he has no memory whatsoever up to the current 10, 20 seconds, or maybe half a minute, depending on whether there have been distractors, any proactive interference. On the whole, his conscious working span memory is that current minute. So everything else behind the minute is blank. So everything until now is unknown and is void. So he uses the analogy of feeling as if he has just woken up. He says it's like just waking up for the first time. It's like just becoming conscious. It's as if I have been unconscious for however many years. And because this is a continual state, unless he's actually engaged on a conversation or on playing Patience or Solitaire, which he does a lot, or on playing the piano or on taking a walk, unless his mind is elsewhere engaged, that is his experience of life, which is, oh, it's as if I've just woken up. Oh, you're the first person I've seen. Oh, I am, you know, and it's this amazement can you imagine what would it be like if you were unconscious and you just came to, but you didn't have a lot of people around your bed saying, oh, you've been unconscious, you're in hospital. You've just got people eating a meal or watching TV as if nothing has happened. So he is habituated to that condition. He realizes that it's not surprising, but he uses that as an analogy for the experience of having no memory. It's as if I've just woken up. And because for him it is momentous, he has to write it down, and he has to write it down on any available surface. If the diary is in front of him, he will write it down there. He will record the time, 10:50 a.m., awake first time, 10, and then he looks at the previous entry, which was 10:48 a.m., awake first time, and he says, no, I wasn't awake then, that wasn't me, that wasn't proper awakeness. This is the first real awakeness. So he goes through the diary, scoring out previous entries and underlining the current new entry, because this now is the real awakeness. All the previous awakenesses are unknown to me. So what he's saying, something about ego, he's saying something about identity. He's saying, I know now, I know this moment now. I have no conscious recollection of those previous entries in my handwriting, though I acknowledge, obviously, they were me.
Okay, stop there a minute. So, just go back to... Okay, so in his early years, Oliver Sacks, who you may know the book The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, talks about various neurological problems that people have had, various case studies. And he says, at the beginning of his illness, Clyde would sometimes be confounded at bizarre things he experienced. One day his wife came in, she saw him holding something in the palm of one hand, repeatedly covering and uncovering it with the other hand, as if he was a magician performing a magic trick. What he's holding was a chocolate. He could feel the chocolate unmoving in his hand, but every time he lifted his hand so he could see it, he told me it revealed a new chocolate. Look, he said, it's new. He couldn't take his eyes off it. It's the same chocolate, I said gently. No, look, it's changed. It wasn't like that before. He covered and uncovered the chocolate every couple of seconds, lifting and looking. It's different again. How do they do that? Okay, so he's just doing that with the chocolate and forgetting he's seen it in between and thinks every time it's a new one. Okay, now initially in the early stages, obviously this, imagine being in his position, it became quite stressful, he became quite desperate, and he got quite depressed. But more recently, so if we go back to, in fact, let's see if I can actually make it work from here this time.
Consigned to live entirely within the present, with terrible consequences.
Okay, this is a BBC video about him. So he can play the piano.
He lost his memory, and now his wife, Deborah, is the only person he recognizes.
So see the example of what I was talking about in a minute. It's as if he hasn't seen her and he does the same thing over and over again.
It's as little as perhaps 7 seconds. It's as little as a sentence.
I'm going to see your sister, Adele. Her daughter's got married recently in New Zealand. And so they're having a party.
Funny how the ladies acquire a different title when they get married.
Do you know who I'm going to see tomorrow?
Buckingham Palace.
No, really guess.
He's at Buckingham Palace.
Oh, okay.
Do you know why I'm going?
No.
She's having a party at her house tomorrow.
It's her birthday, isn't it?
No. Do you know why?
Can you hear that?
It's to do with her daughter.
So he's told her it and he has no recollection. She's told him it.
Yes.
No idea.
She's just got married.
Oh, I see.
She just got married. And do you know what country she's got married in?
No idea.
In New Zealand.
Oh, I see.
The sentence he is in, he will probably have forgotten the sentence before. You ask him a question and he'll give you an answer, but while he's giving you the answer, he's already forgotten the question. That's how short it is.
I'm going to see your kids tomorrow.
She goes through the same thing again.
What are they up to now?
It's like she's just told him, he has to tell him all again.
No idea, I couldn't guess. I don't know what their O-levels were. They hadn't got an O-level last time I was conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what possible thing they could do, did they?
No.
I couldn't possibly guess.
Okay. So the good news is, later years, he became calmer, less desperate, and he developed various coping strategies. Oliver Sacks says a later visit, Clive addressed him as Your Highness, inquired, been at Buckingham Palace, are you the Prime Minister? Are you from the UN? But this was sort of one of his coping strategies. He had no idea who Oliver Sacks was, but he could have a bit of banter to keep a conversation going. So also he suspected there was other damage as well to his frontal lobes. And often Clive would do monologues, because as long as he kept talking, he didn't have to remember then that he'd forgotten where he was in the conversation. If that makes sense. So the sorts of things that we can learn from this. It's not that he has no memory. It's the same as the patient DF, remember we talked about in relation to vision. He has some memory, and DF had some vision, but it's not neurotypical. What he still has is he can speak fluently, he can understand others' speech. He may have forgotten the beginning of a sentence by the time it gets to the end, but he still can understand it. He has some memories of his earlier life before the brain-damaging infection and a variety of general knowledge. He can sight read and play music. So what he's lost is a lot of the declarative knowledge, that is the statable knowledge, for example, about music and composers. He can still conduct a choir. He can do daily routines as long as you don't interrupt him partway through. So what's interesting about this, it's the study of him started to reveal patterns about how memory works. So for example, that long-term memory may be split into explicit declarative memory, which is more the sort of memory for facts, which includes episodic memory, which is history of your life events, and semantic memory, which is basically representation of facts. An implicit non-declarative memory, that is skills, how you do things. So long-term memory actually may be multiple systems. And we're talking about here a long period of time, can be half a minute, you know, or it can be an entire lifetime. You know, there is, you know, your long-term memory works on that scale, but it's not clear there's separate processes within that. And this is as opposed to short-term memory, which we'll talk about tomorrow, whereas short-term memory is really short. It's about, you know, when you're just reciting back numbers, for example. so a few digits worth of numbers. And just to note, that's different. When we talk about short-term memory in everyday speech, we are actually talking about long-term memory, things that we have actually processed and stored. So I said we'll talk about it in the later memory. So one of the things that this, the research of looking at him suggested is that there may be two types of long-term memory: explicit memory, declarative memory, that's knowledge of facts like what did you do at New Year, who's the current prime minister, and as I said, that's divided, and implicit non-declarative memory. So you may learn to perform a skill, you know, people talk about riding a bike, you don't forget how to learn to ride a bike, you just get on it, you ride the bike. And generally, if you think back to when we were talking about some of the cognitive models the other week, we were saying about Anderson's ACTAR model, and in that he distinguishes between declarative learning, where you learn the description of how to do something, you learn the facts. But as something becomes more learnt, more automated, it becomes procedural learning. You learn how to perform a task. So for example, I was saying to you before about, you know, learning, you know, you learn to walk, you learn to drive. And those things maybe are different then once you've learnt them, because they become how-to skills and learning rather than more factual learning. So Gilbert Ryle talks about this distinction as knowing how versus knowing that. Now, the second patient just briefly wanted to mention there, that I mentioned earlier, is HM. As I said, he had seizures, so they removed his hippocampal lobes and the seizures stopped, which is good news. The bad news is he could no longer form new memories. And so up to that point, memory was thought to be distributed around the brain, and they realized that, you know, maybe there was more localization of this. And that link there is to his obituary, but it has quite a lot of information about his condition, what he could and couldn't do, and how, just by studying him alone, made a huge contribution to our understanding of memory. So, you know, you can have these big studies with hundreds of people, or sometimes you look at one person that's an interesting case study in great depth and may learn a huge amount from it. So in his case, he was able to learn things like a very simple maze completion task, but the whole idea of having these multiple interconnected systems was a new one. It suggests that this being able to learn at least a very simple new task, he'd learnt something and stored it in implicit long-term memory. That is, because it had then become sufficiently learned as a skill, he could retain it, as opposed to if you asked him to give a factual description of, like, navigating through the maze, he wouldn't be able to recall that. And he was able to retain some of this for a few days. So similar to, like, if the example with Clive Wearing, he could still play the piano, he could sight read music, he'd retained those skills. He probably couldn't tell you what he was playing, he couldn't tell you who the composer was, he couldn't tell you anything about it, but he could play it. Okay, so in the rest of this week, we're going to be looking at more at other types of memory and models of memory. Semantic memory and schemas, forgetting, and particularly we're going to look at eyewitness misidentification as an example that shows us something about how memory works. And if you remember when we looked at attention, we talked about that as well, what you attend to in a scene, and if you have cases with eyewitnesses, how what they attend to may also affect their recall. So again, showing that these things overlap. There's overlap between vision and attention, between attention and memory, between vision and memory. And we'll talk about those on Thursday and Friday. And the slides for this should already be up on the webpage, I think, for once. I managed to get ahead of you on that one. Okay, we haven't, I'm afraid, yet returned your second assignment, but we will be doing so as soon as we can. And look out for what's happening in the lab going up tomorrow. Next Wednesday, there will be no lab for the course because those of you doing Inf 1 have got mock exams. Yeah. So because of a clash with that, we're just not going to run a lab next week. But there will be a lab this week and there will be a lab probably in the final week. Okay.